This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Modern Transportation World. We're about to speak to Cliff Henke, who is the Director of External Relations and the Chief Spokesman in North America for NABI, and we're going to find out what NABI is. Welcome to Modern Transportation World.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be with you. NABI is the third largest manufacturer of transit buses, that is, buses that are sold to city transit agencies, regional transit agencies in the United States.
Right.
And we're also the third largest manufacturer of buses in the UK through a subsidiary that we have there. We're about a $374 million company on an annual consolidated sales basis.
Okay. Is this what's the international structure of the corporation?
Well, we are owned by a company based in Budapest, Hungary.
Right.
And it serves three markets, primarily the United States market, curiously, is the largest market of the three. And then the UK market is the second largest market for the NABI group, we call it. And then the third and the smallest market is the Hungarian domestic market, which has been depressed of late in the wake of the fall of the Iron Curtain and the 10 years ensuing restructuring the economy and building it up and so on.
Was this company in existence before the Iron Curtain fell?
No, actually, in 1992, right after the fall of the Berlin Wall,
right.
A very astute expatriate Hungarian American citizen by the name of Peter Rona saw Hungarian talent that could be exploited for Western market,
right.
And he did a variety of things through a fund, investment fund that he created in those years called the First Hungary Fund, one of which was to take assets from a formerly state-owned enterprise called Icarus,
right.
Which had been selling a few buses during the 80s and the 70s to the United States. It was one of the few companies that actually earned hard currency for the former state-owned enterprises,
right.
and converted those assets with a few other assets in the United States into a company called North American Bus Industries, which then became the third largest bus manufacturer in the country.
So
that was
pretty
much,
it was pretty much export-oriented from the beginning then?
Yes, very much so. It's one of the largest exporters, in fact, to the United States in Hungary today.
Okay. Now, it says on your website that you're ISO compliant. What is the ISO, and why is ISO compliance an important factor in a manufacturing company's portfolio?
The International Organization for Standardization is what it stands for. It doesn't quite match up with the acronym.
Right.
It's a more than 100-year-old international association, as I understand it. And it's responsible for a variety of standards, including the standard you have on your camera that is for film speed. The ISO that you see on your camera is a result of standards that are put together by this body.
Right.
Well, in 1986, ISO created through its member organizations throughout the world and through a variety of companies and individuals' painstaking effort. A quality management standard called ISO 9001,
right.
And that is the mark of quality throughout the world, and becomes an important distinction for companies trying to demonstrate quality assurance in their products and services to their customers.
What kind of what are the components of it in general that it measures?
Well, it measures basically it documents how you do quality, it makes sure that there's a system in place for incorporating quality even at the conception of a product at the design stage, and that those assurances are carried through to the manufacturing and servicing of the product.
Okay. So you can know it's essentially, it's something like the Underwriters Laboratory mark.
Well, actually, yeah. Underwriters Laboratory essentially is a testing agency that will test to a particular standard or performance benchmark in a variety of products. And I believe UL also does these audits in the quality assurance area. And there are companies like UL that do it if it isn't UL itself.
Is there a monitoring system or an auditing system to make sure that, or to determine whether a company can get that rating, and if so, how it maintains it?
Yes, it is a monitoring, I believe, every 5 or 6 years, and it's a private companies, private consulting companies will come in and do an initial informal audit to see if you're up to snuff, and then will basically help you get there, and then a final audit, and then a certification after that audit. These auditors are actually audited themselves to another standard for auditors.
Right.
So it's a system that has its own checks and balances, all entirely in the private sector, but very important to government-funded markets like the public transportation market or the military market or any other market that's funded with taxpayer dollars. So it becomes a quality measure not only in private sector markets, but in markets that are using taxpayer funds literally throughout the world.
Right. Okay. Thank you for that background. So
sure.
So people are going to know then, because NABI is an ISO 9001 registered company, that the product's going to work.
Right. I mean, it's a measure of quality assurance that our customers can feel comfortable with. That said, however, there are also standards and regulations that are in the public transportation industry itself.
Right.
There are regulations that the Federal Transit Administration has tied to grants it gives cities and states for the use of public transportation grant funds that require a regime of quality assurance steps that are in addition to ISO 9001.
Okay.
So it's not just a sort of deemed quality that these public transportation entities will follow. It is also aside from the requirements that they have in complying with federal guidelines for the federal restrictions, frankly,
right,
on the use of those public transportation funds.
Okay, so these things are pretty thoroughly vetted, we can say,
absolutely,
in summary. Okay, I'm looking at your homepage right now, and there's a picture of a bus here. Is that the one that the Orange Line's going to use?
That's right, yes. What we call the NABI 60 BRT.
Right.
And that designation is for bus rapid transit, a pretty rapidly growing concept in public transportation. And the Orange Line is definitely a poster child example of this concept in America.
Is it pretty much the first and the biggest, or what kind of superlatives between your buses and the Orange Line are there?
Well, we would say a couple of things about that. First, the vehicle itself is what we would call the first sort of third generation bus rapid transit vehicle in the United States.
Go real fast over the first and second generations.
Well, the second generation we believe was the CompoBus, which is one that was produced by our company for applications again in Los Angeles in the Metro Rapid network, as well as in Phoenix for its Rapid service, it called Rapid service.
Right.
And they were a little bit configured. They were configured somewhat differently, but it was the same model of product, and it was advanced composite, highly stylized. In the case of Phoenix, they had suburban, nice plush seats and reading lights and other nice interior amenities. And Los Angeles is more of an arterial, urban kind of configuration, where that branded service is run on top of their local service, but they wanted a distinctive image and a little bit higher capacity vehicle than a traditional 40-foot bus. Because this vehicle was made of advanced composite, it's able to be stretched 5 additional feet to get 6 more seats in, which may not sound like a lot, but when you do it over a fleet of 100 buses, you get quite a few more seats and quite a few more standees and a lot more productivity out of your fleet for exactly the same operating cost.
Right.
So it was an important move for Los Angeles, certainly an important milestone in our customer base as well.
And in fact, so as you've just recounted, the advanced technology makes it a more viable business proposition.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And an important feature of that second generation of the rapid buses, the red and white ones that run in Los Angeles now, was their ability to communicate with traffic lights.
That's right. Actually, in the so-called first generation, which was basically a 40-foot bus that was painted differently.
Right.
It was a distinctive paint scheme, and you've probably seen them running up and down the streets in L.A. That branded service also was able to connect with the street lights as well, so that it would receive a priority at the signal,
right.
Either a longer green or a shorter red, in order to speed up the service. And it's a huge success.
Did that mean, did some people, I just thought of this, that some people might trail the bus in order to take advantage of that feature?
Yeah, actually that's true, and I've actually heard that one of the reasons why they didn't get a whole lot of opposition in that signal priority treatment was because a lot of cars would follow the buses,
like those,
and they would actually get the treatment as well.
Like,
right?
Like the little fish that hang around the sharks, I guess.
Right, yeah. Right. But what those people who are stopped in the opposite direction,
right.
in the other direction, so to speak,
right.
really didn't notice it that much. So it wasn't like there was any community opposition, as I understand it. It was just a few seconds. But those few seconds made a lot of difference in the speed of the bus.
Exactly. Okay. Let's just, people listening to this will presumably be able to link over and take a look at this picture as well as some other ones. But why don't you just describe some of the distinctive features of this model?
Absolutely. Let's get back to the third generation, we call it.
Right.
It is a 60-foot, highly stylized, compressed natural gas-fueled, low-floor, articulated bus.
Okay, take each of those items and talk
sure.
about them.
The stylized features are a pretty advanced design, and one of the major reasons why Los Angeles ordered these vehicles from us. There's a famous story in our company about Roger Snoble, the CEO of the MTA, from his corner office at the MTA headquarters, pointing down from his office and saying, "I don't want to buy any more shoe boxes."
Right.
And we listened to those words very carefully, and we determined that we would definitely want to keep LA as one of our very good customers.
Right.
And so we undertook a lot of design internally to come up with a proposal that Los Angeles would like.
It doesn't look like a shoebox to me.
It's definitely not a shoebox. It's very distinctive looking, and that's very important to Los Angeles in trying to attract riders out of their cars.
Okay. Talk about the fuel system, and I haven't seen any natural gas, compressed natural gas stations. Where do these things fuel up?
The fueling is at LA's own fueling depots,
right.
Their own service divisions, and they're centrally fueled, and that's probably one of the reasons why public transportation has been one of the faster growing industries for compressed natural gas propulsion, or natural gas propulsion in general, because they're centrally fueled. It's easier to change a fleet of vehicles over to a different fuel when they all are fueled from the same facility.
Is there one facility in Los Angeles,
no,
or several?
Several. Mark, there are several throughout the greater LA basin.
Okay.
I'm not sure if all of the LA divisions have natural gas fueling facilities, but certainly quite a few of them do.
Okay, now, how are engines that run on compressed natural gas different than engines that run on diesel fuel or gasoline?
They're basically, they have to be configured internally differently so that the gas actually is burned differently. And so I'm not an engine expert, but
right.
clearly a lot of research was done by the two primary engine manufacturers in this country, Cummins Westport and Detroit Diesel, to adapt a diesel engine to natural gas.
Did they use
initially there yeah. was a spark ignition just like a gasoline engine,
right.
but that then changed over to different kinds of control management within the engine. It's, you know, a result of a lot of mechanical engineering as well as electronic engineering.
Right.
So that the controls of the engine are very different from a diesel engine.
Do these engines use? So in other words, these are specially configured engines that are designed to burn a compressed natural gas.
Yes, I mean you look at a piston of a natural gas engine, and it's very different from a piston of a diesel engine.
Are you saying it works without a spark plug the way a diesel does?
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay, but what's the relative cost of both financially and environmentally for the use of compressed natural gas as opposed to diesel or gasoline?
Well, there is a cost to cleaner air. The natural gas engines traditionally have been several thousand dollars more expensive, and the fueling, plumbing and the storage arrangements on a bus are about $20,000 difference,
right.
$20,000 to $40,000 difference,
right.
Between a diesel versus a natural gas bus configured in the same way otherwise.
Okay, now before we get to the environmental benefits, on the downside, people talk about the explosive potential of huge tankers holding compressed natural gas. Does that problem still exist, and are steps taken to remediate it in buses?
Well, there's been a lot of talk about the explosive nature of natural gas versus diesel.
Right.
While on the one hand, natural gas does have a certain potential for that, gasoline is actually more inherently dangerous because the combustion point is actually lower with gasoline.
It's essentially easier to ignite it.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Right.
And then, you know, because it's not so much the explosive nature of natural gas that is big a danger, frankly.
Right.
It's probably the fact that it's under pressure.
Right. And the need to keep it under, how does that make it dangerous or not?
Well, it's just high pressure. It's well over 2,000 pounds per square inch.
Right.
And anything that's under high pressure is going to create a little bit more danger than something under low pressure.
Right. And are those pressures maintained within the bus, within the fuel storage system?
Well, it has to be, yes. There are well-designed tanks now. That technology has evolved quite a lot over the past decade. And so they're fiberglass wound aluminum tanks that are able to withstand very high pressures. They're very safe. A lot of redundancy built into the safety of the systems. And the contractor that we've got that actually puts this whole system together, that's sort of our systems integrator, has done literally thousands of buses now in America. And so there's been a lot of know-how, a lot of knowledge developed about this technology over the past decade.
So people don't have to worry about that as a factor.
I would say they would probably have to worry more about whether or not a gas tank is rear-ended and explodes more than they would have to worry about natural gas fuel.
Okay, we've talked about some of the things to worry about here. Talk about the environmental benefits of using compressed natural gas as opposed to diesel or gasoline.
Compressed natural gas is clearly, natural gas is clearly more clean burning, clearly cleaner burning than diesel. No question about it.
Go ahead.
Having said that, the EPA standard in 2007 for natural gas and diesel will have to be the same. I mean, they mandated now in 2007 that diesel meet the same standard as natural gas emissions.
So that's a good benefit of the use of natural gas to force the diesel standard higher.
Right. It has forced diesel to get cleaner.
So if people want to still use diesel, they're going to have to make it as clean as natural gas.
That's correct. And so the cost of diesel propulsion is going to increase thanks to you're going to need to use what they call ultra-low sulfur diesel, which is a few cents a gallon higher, as well as make the entire propulsion system more expensive, so that the cost of both of those technologies are going to converge somewhat as well. Having said that, however, diesel will be, I believe, cleaner, or excuse me, less expensive than natural gas. In addition, however, there are some unregulated emissions that are a little make natural gas a little cleaner, but there are other emissions, such as greenhouse gas emissions, that that make diesel probably more attractive. So the world is going to get very interesting after 2007.
So in fact, there's still a nip and tuck race here between diesel and natural gas.
Yes, there is.
Okay, but you've essentially put your money on natural gas.
Well, it's what the customer has demanded.
Okay.
I mean, we Los Angeles has committed itself to an all natural gas fleet, and we certainly honor that commitment.
Okay.
And we've provided them with buses that comply with their commitment.
How many horsepower do these engines generate?
These particular buses will generate, I believe it's 330 horsepower. If it isn't 330, that's 320.
Okay. Talk about the articulated aspect. I'm looking at it. There's a bellows here between the front and the back. How does that work? What's the point of that exactly?
Well, it's a very sophisticated system. It isn't just the bellows. The bellows sort of shrouds, if you will. It's a kind of a double-walled bellows, which is part of the advanced design to give the sort of roof line a kind of rail-like feel, so you don't actually see the two bodies actually separate. It tries to give it a more streamlined look.
Right.
But in between the two walls, if you will, there are all kinds of natural gas fuel lines and other kinds of things between the two walls. The bellows itself, the interior bellows also shrouds a very sophisticated anti-jackknife system that's been developed over the years in the industry. That anti-jackknife system is needed because these buses are propelled from the rear of the rear body.
Right.
They're so-called pushers,
right,
rather than pullers.
Okay.
Many of the articulated buses in Europe have the propulsion system on the front body, which then pulls the trailing unit.
Right.
And it's a little bit simpler technology, whereas these, this basically standard articulated bus in America has for years, decades now, been a so-called pusher unit, and it requires a sophisticated anti-jackknifing system.
So it's essentially what in cars is a traditional rear-wheel drive, and yet, but then the energy is transmitted up to the front, and it's steered from the front unit.
Well, steered from the front. That's right. The driver sits up front as always.
But there's not like a fire truck. There's no one in the back car steering the back car.
No, it's just the one operator.
And it works that, and the force is transmitted through the bellows to the front unit as well.
That's correct. Right. I mean, it's not like the any of the other axles are driven with their own propulsion. The entire drive of it is from the rear forward.
Okay, and in terms of axles, there are two axles on the front unit and one on the back?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Say something just a little bit about the statistics here. How many of these buses have been ordered? How much they cost? How many people can fit in one of them and so on?
They are $633,000 at the prices that were the MTA bought them in, I believe, 2002, early 2002.
Okay. And how many did they buy
They bought 200 in the base order, and there are options for 400 additional.
Okay, and how many have been built so far?
Well, only one.
Oh.
Because that was a prototype vehicle.
Right.
They did a lot of testing and public displays and so on.
Is that the one I'm looking at here on the webpage?
That's right. And then 30 more are going to be delivered by May, I believe it's May, we can say the first half of 2005, this year.
Right.
time for the revenue opening date in August
right.
of this orange line.
Okay.
And then the remainder would be of that base order, the remaining 170 will be delivered throughout the balance of 2005 and into 2006.
Okay, now are these only going to be available there on the Orange Line in Los Angeles, or are they going to be
in
anywhere
Los
else?
In Los Angeles, the 30 will be available only on the Orange Line. And then my understanding is that Los Angeles plans to spread the remainder of that 200 base order, plus any options that they would order, on the rest of their Metro Rapid system. Los Angeles has embarked on a rather ambitious expansion of its Metro Rapid system, Mark, thanks to the initial success of the two lines that were rolled out in, I believe, 2001, maybe late 2000, in which case ridership went up, you know, nearly 40% on the Wilshire Boulevard Metro Rapid line,
right.
and quite a bit on the Ventura Boulevard line. So it was such a success that the board then voted to expand this network to a network, if you will, of 28 routes comprising more than 400 miles by 2008, rolling out two additional routes in the Metro Rapid network every 6 months.
So
I think that nine or something like that, you'd have to check with the MTA website.
Right.
But I think nine currently are in operation.
So does that mean that the red and white ones, the second generation, are going to be spreading to new routes, and that these Orange Line implemented ones will be taking over, essentially migrating into those existing rapid routes?
No, the 30 Orange Line vehicles, and probably a few more as service ridership demands on that Orange Line, and we expect, LA officials expect, ridership to grow quite a bit on the Orange Line after it's rolled out in August.
Right.
And so, you know, additional vehicles will be used beyond the 30 of that order to accommodate that increased ridership. But really, the rest of them would be rolled out in existing and new Metro Rapid routes through the expansion plans that,
right. So,
that
so,
LA has.
Right. So the first ones will be only on the Orange Line,
right.
but subsequent to that, they will also be used on the existing and new rapid
that's correct.
Routes.
That's correct. To supplement the 100 compo buses, the 45-footers we were talking about, the Generation 2 vehicle we were talking about earlier.
Are you making any more of those, or have they been discontinued to be replaced by this?
We are making only 100 for Los Angeles. Currently, there are no plans to order any additional ones.
Okay. Talk about the amenities available when someone, I assume that these are wheelchair compliant?
That's correct, yeah. They're low floor, and I believe the idea is for them to have as level boarding as possible so that the stations on this new Orange Line will be, you know, as level as possible. They are equipped with ramps just like any other low-floor bus in America, and so that they're fully accessible.
Okay.
I believe there are three wheelchair positions on the 60-footers.
Okay. Say something about the synergy between the buses and the Orange Line. To what extent do they work together? To what extent was each component designed to work with the other?
Well, basically, the Orange Line, these buses have the distinctive look because the Orange Line has a distinctive type of a service. It's
right.
going to be treated as the next route in the Metro Rail system
right.
in Los Angeles, and so they wanted to give it a silver paint scheme that was distinct from the other buses plying the streets of Los Angeles County,
right.
and they wanted to give it a distinctive with the stations that they're constructing, the exclusive roadway that they're constructing that these vehicles will operate on.
Does that mean most of the way they'll be the only vehicle on that road?
Virtually all of the way, entirely separated from the rest of traffic.
Okay.
And only would be in mixed traffic at intersections.
All right.
In the other directions.
But in the direction they're going, they're going to be the only thing
That's
on the road
correct.
There. Okay.
Yes.
Say something
like, just like one of their light rail lines.
Yes, compare the cost and efficiency and speed and throughput of light rail and these buses.
Sure. Light rail, that's one of the beauties of bus rapid transit, Mark, is that it's basically the way the FTA, the Federal Transit Administration, defined it. It's sort of thinking rail with buses.
Okay.
And the cost is dramatically lower in most cases.
How dramatically?
Well, the average cost of the of a rail line is about $35 million a mile.
Okay.
This particular Orange Line project is $330 million total project cost, and I believe it's 14 miles.
Does that include the buses or just the...
Including the buses, yes.
$330 million for 14 miles and the buses to run on.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And if that had been light rail, what might it have cost?
Well, you know, $35 million or $50 million times 14.
Right.
Could easily be close to a $1 billion light rail line.
So three times as much, more or less.
Yes, very much so. And that's rather typical of bus rapid transit. Sure, there are some light rail projects in America that go, you know, $18 million, $20 million a mile, using very off the shelf, so to speak, rail car designs and not much amenities in terms of civil engineering.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is the Government Accountability Office did a report a few years ago on light rail, and I believe the estimate was around $35 million a mile was the average estimate for a rail line.
Right.
Bus rapid transit, on the other hand, it comes in at even in the high end, in the teens of millions per mile.
At least half.
Least less than half.
Okay.
And as far as vehicles are concerned, Mark, our vehicle was 633,000, you know, in an order of 200 to Los Angeles. I believe that they've bought rail cars from Siemens between, 2 and 3 million.
2 or 3 million, essentially three or more times.
That's right.
Well,
even when you consider that the design life of these vehicles is 12 years versus a 20-year design life of a light rail vehicle, you can buy two of them or more for the price of a light rail vehicle.
And of course, you could buy the improved version at towards the end of that the cycle of the unit.
That's absolutely right. I mean, we're envisioning that these would be hybrid electric probably later in this decade or next decade. We're thinking about how to do hybrid electric with this vehicle.
Is that with hybrid electric using the compressed natural gas?
Diesel hybrid electric will be first.
Right.
There are now some pretty well commercialized hybrid systems now for buses and almost all of them involve diesel hybrid, although Los Angeles would probably look at a CNG hybrid only because of its board commitment to having CNG as its fuel.
There's no reason why that couldn't be done.
There's no reason, no technical reason. It would make a hybrid even cleaner, but it would be, that much more expensive because you're not saving any cost in the CNG part of the propulsion system, and then you're adding, some $200,000 per vehicle for the hybrid system, more or less.
Was any consideration given to making these completely electric? Would that have been feasible? Would catenaries been necessary over the line, or what?
That's exactly right. I believe that the Orange Line initially was looking at a trolley bus, what they call a trolley bus type of configuration.
Right.
But of course, you have to consider the tens of millions of dollars to electrify that line and all of the operational training and whatnot requirements that would go with electrifying a line. And I believe clear back in the 80s, there was some talk of some trolley bus lines in Los Angeles, thanks to the advent of hybrid systems as well as the cleaner burning conventional propulsion systems in buses, they elected, the board of LA elected to discontinue any additional work on electric trolley buses. That said, however, they are looking at what their needs to comply with future requirements for clean air as well as their energy needs in the next decade or two. And trolley buses are one of the technologies that are under study.
Okay. And in fact, the hybrid technology that we were talking about is essentially the same as runs now in such personal cars as the Prius.
It's what's called a parallel drive system, so that it's got a blending of mechanical and electric propulsion.
Right.
Computer controlled. I believe that's how the Prius does work. The leading manufacturer in hybrid systems for buses is Allison.
Right.
The maker of the conventional mechanical transmission. There's also a pretty good system made by Siemens that is what they call a series hybrid.
And all of these essentially work by emphasizing that the motor is driven by the combustion engine, but it stores a lot of electricity that it generates, including from... I once drove an EV1, and the idea was that a lot of the energy generated when you brake was reconverted into electrical energy and stored.
That's exactly right, yeah. And in transit, it's particularly attractive with a lot of stopping and going.
Right.
And you want to recapture that braking energy, absolutely.
So your plan would be to capture that energy in the new hybrid generation.
That's right.
Because generation 4 would essentially be...
It would
that
be a generation 4, absolutely.
Right. Okay, talk about the amenities. Let's say I get on the bus. What will I expect to see inside?
Well, you're going to see a little bit more inviting, stylized interior. That said, however, it's still going to be, you know, one that LA will it's going to be a functional interior that they're careful to have anti-graffiti elements and they want to have enough seats for capacity purposes.
Right.
But if you have a bicycle, the bicycle rack will be inside, so you can store your bicycle on board and not on the front of the vehicle, so that reduces the stopping time at a station.
So people would carry their bikes on.
That's right. And inside as well, you're going to see a next stop announcement system with a kind of a variable message sign.
Right.
That will show you what the next stop is, or make sure for those people who are hearing impaired, they don't have to necessarily hear the announcement; they can read the announcement.
Right. There's a question I've wanted to get answered for a while here. Are these buses equipped with seat belts, or is there some reason why there aren't seat belts in buses?
It's partly the fact that you know. In any kind of a crash, the bus is going to survive.
I mean, right.
It's a much, much bigger, much heavier vehicle on the road than just about anything else.
By the laws of physics, the man.
Yeah, and I think that the transit industry in general has made the determination that, you know, with a stopping and starting, you're talking about a vehicle that's, you know, physically able to survive anything, but you also want to make it a functional one. People can easily get off and on, and you don't have to, you know, look and, you know, make sure everybody's seat belts are fastened and all of that. It would just reduce the efficiency of public transportation. Plus, public transportation as an industry, Mark, is considerably safer in terms of number of deaths per 1,000 miles traveled or by any measure. Safer than just about any other mode of transportation.
Okay, from the point of view of the driver, how tough is it going to be to drive these? What kind of driver aids are provided?
Well, there's going to be additional training. It's one of the reasons why we're developing, why we're delivering the first 30 a few months before the revenue opening date. They want to have additional familiarization training. But from a maneuverability standpoint, articulated buses, believe it or not, are pretty maneuverable, and just as maneuverable. Some people would argue even more maneuverable than a 40-foot transit bus, but clearly just as maneuverable.
How long are these buses?
They're 60 feet.
Okay. Is it a 30-30 breakdown between the two units, or is it 40-20, or how big is each one relative to the other?
You know what? I haven't really looked at an elevation drawing and really kind of measured that.
Okay.
I think that the first body, so to speak, of the two units is a little bit longer
right.
than the second body, but the turning circle is still considerably... It's virtually the same, if not shorter, than the turning circle of a traditional 40-foot bus, but it's also considerably shorter than our 45-foot bus. So, you know, when you go up higher in capacity, you do have to deal with maneuverability issues of the two higher capacity units in our product line. And I would say that from a maneuverability standpoint, the 60-foot unit is more maneuverable than the 45-foot unit.
Okay. What's the capacity? How many passengers can it hold at once? Let me break that down into two. How many passengers can sit in it at once, and how many can it hold?
57 seated passengers, and then roughly 30 more as standees.
Right.
So 90 or so.
Okay.
In a full load. And in a crush load, even more than that.
Okay, up to 100 then, you'd say.
Yeah, up to 100 I think is a pretty good number.
Oh, and of course people can go back and forth between the two units. That's part of the articulation process.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
What can you say about any new innovations in, I guess that's redundant, any innovations in ticketing and how that's going to be handled on the bus, in the stations?
I'm glad you asked that. One of the things in the higher end of bus rapid transit is to try to reduce the dwell time at stations.
Right.
And ticketing will be off board just as it is with the light rail line.
Right.
So that it's at the station, you'll buy your ticket, and then you just you board the vehicle once you get to the station on the orange line, and the ticketing will be enforced by roving inspectors in the same manner as it's enforced on light rail lines.
Is the fare structure such that you get a pass for a time period or a distance, or how does that work?
Well, I believe the fare structure is going to be basically the same as other light rail lines in the LA system. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that's the only way of doing fares in the industry. And there are a number of things. They're zone based. They're distance based. They're flat fare with a transfer. There are flat fares that you have to also pay for a transfer. So. In the LA system, I don't remember exactly what their plans are for the Orange Line, but I do believe it's the same as their Gold Line or any other light rail line or the Red Line.
So essentially people will get to the station and then and they buy their ticket and get admitted to a second area where they're going to wait for the bus. And then as soon as the bus arrives, then they just get on.
That's right. That's right.
But they will have some kind of a pass with them. Is there going to be a conductor wandering around the bus asking to randomly to see people's passes or what?
Just as there is on the Gold Line or the Red Line or any of the other rail lines in Los Angeles' system, yes, there will be basically roving inspectors.
Okay. Now, say a little bit more about the electronics in the bus and how it's going to communicate with the streetlights and facilitate its passage through the intersections.
It'll have a similar type of a system as it does on the Metro Rapid system in general. I believe it's going to be a little bit more sophisticated because there are some intersections on the Orange Line that actually are three-way intersections. But generally speaking, Mark, they will receive a priority at the intersection just as the Metro Rapid system will receive
so essentially the bus through are there transceivers over the road?
Yes,
and the bus will be sending out a signal to those transceivers, so the transceiver says, here's a bus, it's 300 yards from the intersection, it's passing under me now, there's going to be a signal going to some decentralized, centralized computer. Is this going to happen essentially at each intersection, or is it going to be controlled from some headquarters?
It's a centralized computer system that is controlled from, I believe, the L.A. Department of Transportation headquarters.
So it essentially will be monitoring the, it will be able to monitor in real time the position of the bus.
That's exactly right.
And then calculate how much extra time it might need, and then modify the cross signal at the same time so that everyone has sufficient warning by yellow lights that they're going to need to slow down and stop to let the bus by.
That's exactly right. It's a rather sophisticated system that LA has, and it's all automatic, centrally controlled. In other words, the driver doesn't have to ask manually,
right,
by pushing a button for a priority request.
Right. Okay. Now, given all that, there's obviously then a lot of electronic gear on the bus already. What are the possibilities of retrofitting the bus and the line to provide a Wi-Fi or other wireless service within the bus so that the commuters, and we haven't talked much about that, we're going to sort of wrap up with that, the demographics of who's going to be using this, to provide a Wi-Fi service for people within the bus so they can get some work done on their laptop computers?
It's an interesting, fascinating question, and I know that it's been under discussion by several people within Los Angeles, as well as others in the industry,
okay,
for precisely the reasons that you're talking about. That is to say, let's get the busy executive out of his BMW,
right,
and on transit, and let him work,
or her, of course,
on board.
Right,
that's
him
exactly
or her,
right,
to work. And in fact, where are those discussions now, would you say?
Well, I would say they're pretty far along because the let's face it, the technology is not that difficult.
Right.
I mean, it's basically an extra dimension of things that already go on the bus. That is to say, there is wireless monitoring available on vehicles in the industry now. There is communications with the bus's depot. There are communications with the bus in case of emergency. We do have onboard video surveillance, not only of these buses, but on the rest of the buses that have been ordered in Los Angeles.
Does that online video surveillance go back through wireless means to the headquarters?
I don't know if these vehicles will be equipped so equipped, but it is technically possible.
And you know,
it is available
okay,
to
and
the
you,
industry.
Yeah, and you know, of course, that the Mayor Hunt has just made a proposal, a request for information, in fact, about how to use the hundreds of thousands of streetlights and tens of thousands of traffic lights in Los Angeles for wireless communication. I don't know if you know about that, but he's...
No, I didn't know about that, but, I mean, again, all of this, you know, is because there is a standard, 802, you know, 11, now G,
right,
for Wi-Fi. The fact that there is an open architecture for Wi-Fi standard...
Right.
It just makes it that much easier to layer on the kinds of services that we've been talking about.
So, in fact, given an appropriate technology to hand off the provisioning of the Wi-Fi in the bus from stationary transceivers along the route, it would be relatively easy to put a Wi-Fi transponder in the bus, and it would essentially be a rolling Starbucks. And you would have that access within the bus.
Yes.
Has that been proposed either as an added revenue enhancement for the MTA or as an inducement that would be available for free, and you'd end up getting people who could who would want to ride the bus all day just to access the Wi-Fi?
More the latter than the former.
Okay.
More an inducement to a free inducement, a loss leader, if you will,
right,
to entice ridership.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the ridership. Are you essentially shooting for these people who are stuck on the 101 going back and forth across the valley now, or are you going to get other demographic groups? Who's your target audience here?
Well, our target audience is the target audience of our customers, and I would say, if I could speak for them, would be... They're targeting both the traditional user of transit, but more importantly, they want to grow their market share, so to speak, along those corridors that they're trying to serve.
Right.
And in this particular corridor, you bet they're going after the choice rider, the one that can't get out of his car or her car and ride transit instead of slogging along the 101 in traffic.
Okay, what are you calculating are the potential time savings or money savings or both?
Not sure what the planners have simulated there in their models.
Right.
But I can tell you on the Metro Rapid system to date that roughly a third of the increase in ridership has been because of people getting out of their cars.
Okay.
New riders.
Now, this isn't really a bus issue, it's more an MTA issue, but maybe you could say a little bit about it. I didn't talk about it yesterday with the project manager from MTA. What about the selection of the stops? How were they chosen? How do they fit into the transportation ecology of the valley, if I could use that term, in terms of trying to find the places that most of the people are going to want to stop at?
Well, they are definitely carefully chosen from a functionality standpoint. That is to say, I mean, I can tell you from just sort of, you know, absorbing this thinking through osmosis and talking to our customers,
right,
that, you know, there's thought given to where the stops are located, both from a functionality standpoint, can you fit the civil works in there,
right,
as well as what makes sense in the neighborhood and what could stimulate development, what is accessible to that particular stop in that particular location.
How many stops are there?
I believe it's one every half mile. You'd have to look at the route and
look
at their website. But,
right,
you know, the idea is again to be like light rail, where the stops are fairly spaced apart like light rail, because you don't want it too frequent, because that slows the vehicle down,
right,
and it, you know, loses the advantage of transit to the car.
Right.
But at the same time, you want enough of them that you're going to attract ridership, you know, in the community and make it make sense. And there's a happy medium there, and there are industry rules of thumb, and clearly the planners have been following those. I would dare say that it's basically what you're going to see on the Gold Line or the Green Line or the Red Line in L.A.
Okay. Now, speaking of these other lines, where does the Orange Line and these buses fit into the larger picture?
Well, basically, it's considered a lower cost, faster deployed equivalent of their rail system.
Right.
They are marketing it as the Orange Line in the Metro Rail system.
Oh, okay.
And so it will be on an equal in quality and in perception, hopefully, to the public, to the Gold Line, the Green Line, the Red Line, or any of the other, you know, the Metro Rail Rapid Transit system.
Right.
It is their first rubber-tired rapid transit line.
This is where the rubber meets the road.
Exactly.
And that is
what they're shooting for.
Okay. As I was looking at the Metro map in preparation for this, it looked to me like a route. What was missing is a route through east to west on Sunset Boulevard. Is that something that might turn into another Orange Line someday or something like it?
It's possible. I mean, you'd have to talk to the planners, you know, Jim Delalosa or somebody like that who's in charge of looking at the whole network and what makes sense. But, you know, the beauty of bus rapid transit is that it is flexible enough to run on arterial streets in Los Angeles, because L.A. has the benefit of a lot of rather wide arterial, fast-moving arterial streets.
Right.
But it also can operate in its own transit way, like the Orange Line, and it can also serve as an incremental step toward a rail line down the road, you know, in the future. And so it has a range of applications that, when you talk about a deployment over 2008 or over a decade, you're going to get a lot of network for, relatively speaking, a relatively lower investment that can be implemented much quicker than just a rail-only solution.
Right. And no, in fact, now that the bus has been developed to run on the on the bus-only expressway. These could go on the freeway, couldn't they?
Oh, absolutely. They are rated at a speed that is definitely freeway capable.
So, in fact, after maybe cleaning up the 101 a little bit, these could also run on the 405.
Sure. And in fact, that's what Phoenix, Arizona has done with their bus rapid transit network, is that it runs a lot in park and rides in the suburbs, and then, you know, in the HOV lanes in the freeways, and then has a circulator set of stops once it reaches downtown.
Right. So this is as Howard Hughes repeats to himself endlessly at the end of The Aviator, the way of the future, the way of the future, the way of the future.
We think so. We think that it has a number of applications in the future of transportation in cities throughout America, and Los Angeles being a model example of that future.
Okay, let's wrap up with just one more point. What's the publicly traded nature of the North America bus industries? If people think this is the way of the future and they want to invest in it, is this a publicly traded company?
It is a publicly traded company. It's a bit difficult to buy stock. We would encourage you to do so. It's listed on the Hungarian Stock Exchange.
Right.
And you can buy it through... you can go to the website and find out the investor details through www.nabi.hu, since it's a Hungarian company with an American subsidiary that's obviously a chief player in America.
Right.
And then there are ways you can buy it through deposit receipts in institutions in New York, and that explanation is on the website.
On the
nabi.hu website.
And does it have a ticker symbol?
Yes, it's just NABI, NABI.
All right. I think that's about all we can say about it right now. Hopefully we can speak again closer to the rollout date, what you call the revenue start date.
The revenue start date is in August, and I'd love to talk to you again about it.
Okay, good. Well, thanks very much for talking to us about it now, and I'm looking forward to riding this bus myself.
Thanks again, Mark. Glad to be with you.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye.